street from where we just were. 2 Samuel 11. We're going to be reading a pretty lengthy text here, starting in verse 1, going all the way through verse 15 of chapter 12. Calvin has volunteered to read that for us. So go ahead, Calvin.
Said to Nathan, as the Lord lives, the man who has done this deserves to die, and he he shall restore the land fourfold, because he did this wicked, and because he had no pity. Nathan said to David, you are the man. Blessed is the Lord, the God of Israel. I am going to be king over Israel, and I will lift you out of the hand of Saul. And I gave you your master's house, and your master's body into your arms, and gave you the house of Israel and Judah. If this were too little, I would add to you as much as more. Why have you despised the word of the Lord to do with the people of his sight? You have struck down your brother by the sword, and have taken his wife to be your wife, and have killed him with the sword of the Ammonites. Now therefore, the sword shall never depart from your house, because you have despised me, and have taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your wife. Thus says the Lord, behold, I will raise up evil against you out of your own house, and I will take your wives before your eyes and give them to your neighbor, and he shall lie with your wives in the sight of this son. For you did it secretly, but I will do this thing before all of Israel and before the son. David said to Nathan, I have sinned against the Lord. And Nathan said to David, the Lord also has put away your sin. You shall not die. Nevertheless, because by this deed you have utterly sworn the Lord, the child who is born to you shall die. Then Nathan went to his house.
All right. Thanks, Calvin. That was quite a chunk. Appreciate it. All right, so as we think about this, again, just real quickly, think about kind of where David is in this whole thing outside of this chapter and a half. You read this chapter and a half, and again, what we tend to do with this part of David's life is we kind of extract it, and we like look at it as if it's isolated from all the other things that are being said about this guy. And the reality is, if you look at the chapters leading up to this, again, this seems to be kind of like David's golden age. It seems to be this really high place where David has done some extraordinary things, and he's exhibited extraordinary faith, even exhibited like reckless almost kindness and mercy and love to the people that are around him. He's in chapter 8. He's won over his enemies. Chapter 9. He's had this thing that we just talked about with Mephibosheth. In chapter 10, he has greater military successes. And so he's, at this moment in his life, politically secure. He's shown himself to be spiritually faithful. And his approval ratings are through the roof. If they had approval ratings, then it would have been much higher than any president probably we've ever seen in the history of our country. Everybody loved David. Everything was great, which is what should absolutely terrify us about this story. That's the scariest thing about David and Bathsheba. And if you take it out of its context, like if you take it out of that chunk where we're seeing all these extraordinary things happen to David, and we're seeing this extraordinary faith in David, then you don't realize how much of a cautionary tale David and Bathsheba is. And it's the kind of cautionary tale that if you're being honest with yourself and you're trying to take it to heart and you're not using it to elevate yourself and look down on David and feel better about yourself, if you're not being predatory about it, then it's something that will strike the fear of God in your heart. Because what it reveals is that there are no safeguards in this life. There's nothing that we can do. There's no spiritual accomplishments that we can experience that will safeguard us from making mistakes. If David in this moment in his life can make this mistake, then we're all susceptible of making mistakes. Big mistakes. Catastrophic mistakes. You get to the reason I wanted a portion of that second chapter there, chapter 12 read, is because I wanted us to see what the fallout of all of this is. And this, we didn't even read all of it come to fruition. But everything that God said was going to happen to David happened to David. And when you read about it happening, it's just heartbreaking. David literally is run out of his own capital by his own son. His own son takes his wives, David's wives, and has sex with them publicly in front of everybody, disgraces David in the most kind of obvious ways, the most extravagant ways. David and Bathsheba lose this baby. The baby dies in David's arms, right in front of him. It's just tragedy after tragedy after tragedy. And it actually is kind of, I think, the beginning of a kind of decline in David's life that results in his children not respecting him, his kids turning against him. It ends up being kind of like this whole kind of thing from this point on where David is just kind of like messing up and trying to fix it or reeling from the realities of his previous mess ups. And his life changes dramatically at this point. It just kind of tips. And he has successes. There's good things that happen that are sprinkled in there. But by and large, it's kind of a tough go from this point on. This really is kind of the high point in David's life. And the only person to blame for it tipping the other direction is David. On this text, N.T. Wright wrote this. He said, "Moments of security can breed either deeper faithfulness," that is an option, right? "Or dangerous complacency. Which way it goes depends on the habits of the heart before success arrives." And I have to agree with him. His kind of take on this moment is that David didn't just do this. That this didn't just happen out of nowhere. That there was something happening inside of David all the while all of those good things are going on that we read about that manifested in this moment. That you don't just do the things that David did. That's his take. That's N.T. Wright's take. I don't know if I take as extreme of a position on this moment in David's life, but there certainly are indicators, and we'll talk about those in a second, that show us that it wasn't just a moment of weakness. There were things that led up to this that were decisions that David made that contributed to this downfall and the things that kind of were the fallout afterwards. The Bible warns us about success. The Bible actually warns us a lot about success. And the Bible's take isn't don't be successful. The Bible's take is when you are successful, be very, very diligent. Be very, very careful. And I think that's really at the heart of N.T. Wright's kind of acknowledgement in this text, is that sometimes the scariest times, what should be the scariest times to us in our life, are the times when we perceive that we are doing the best. When we perceive that we are experiencing great spiritual or even kind of life victories. That when that happens, there should be a switch, kind of a warning switch. It just kind of happens in the mind of a Christian, in the mind of a believer, that you are not excluded from the great temptations of this life because you're on some sort of high. And I think that's kind of the primary lesson. Proverbs 16, verse 18, the famous one, said, "Pride goes before destruction." 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 12 says, "Let anyone who thinks that he stands take heed lest he fall." We don't think that we're standing unless there's some sort of physical evidence that encourages us to think that we should stand, right? So Paul says, anybody that thinks that they have what it takes to make it, you better be careful. Because that could very well be the beginning of the end for you. Success can lull us into self-sufficiency. It could make us lose sharpness, spiritual awareness. It could cause us to not focus as much on being spiritually discerning. And it could ultimately make us, of course, very vulnerable to sin and to temptation. And I think I can say this for myself. I don't know if you can say it for you, but in the years that I've walked the earth, in the years that I've dedicated myself to serving God, the most vulnerable I've ever been is when I believe I'm doing well. And I can tell you I've made probably my biggest mistakes right after what I would consider my greatest successes. That's just the way that the human mind works. We tend to gravitate towards what is easy. And so because we're like that, we have to acknowledge it. We have to acknowledge that that's part of the human condition, is to want to have confidence in oneself. Part of the human condition is to allow ourselves, because we want to be lulled into a place of comfort and ease. And this life is not comfortable, and it is, again, not easy. So here the lesson title and the points of the lesson are the same in this particular one. How do we mess up a good thing? Because that's what people do. And so we've got to ask that question. How do we mess up a good thing? I'm not going to ask why, because I don't know. We're dumb. That's the answer. I don't know how to answer that question. But I think we can learn from this particular case in David's life how it happens. So how do we mess up a good thing? And then when we do that, which, by the way, we all do, okay? There's a part of the story, all of us, and it's kind of, it's the first of two terrible things that David does. We should all be able to look at that and say, all right, that's me. I get it, right? But when we do that, when we do the first bad thing that we shouldn't do, and it doesn't have to be adultery, it could be a lot of things. It could be anything, really, anything that God says not to do. It could be any of those things. How do we as humans then make that bad situation a worse situation? Which we all have the capacity to do. Many times in my life, I'm sure you can think about the times in your life that you've done something you shouldn't have done, and instead of saying, oh, what am I doing? I gotta stop. I need to step back. I need to see what's going on here, and I need to get back on track. We just spiral. So we have not only just a way of doing the wrong things, but we have a way of taking those moments in life and making them way worse than they have to be. How do we take a bad thing and make it worse? And then how do we get back? Many times in my life, I found myself at the bottom of a pit that I dug, and I look up to the top and I think, I don't know how to do this. I don't know how to get out of this. And so I think this story is really good in helping us learning to recover. So how do we mess a good thing up? Which we do. How do we make it worse oftentimes? And if we do make it worse, how do we get out of it? So when you think about how David messed up a good thing, obviously the kind of the base level observation, the low-hanging fruit is there were a series of smaller missteps, right? And we point these things out often. I won't spend a lot of time on them. Verse 1 tells us that it was springtime, and God knew that people not in ancient times would be reading this someday, so he let us know that springtime was the time the kings went out and fought wars because the weather was good. We go to the beach, they fought wars. So weather started getting good, time to go out and fight, right? But David remains home in Jerusalem. David is the warrior king of Israel. This is his job. This is what God called him for. And David decides to stay home. So he's, number one, neglecting his duties. This is what he's supposed to be doing. That's going to be an obvious lesson for us. How do you not make a good thing bad thing? Do what God told you to do. Stay in duty, right? Be who you're supposed to be. Be who God called you to be. In verse 2, we get this picture of him being idle. He's up. It says he's up kind of like later in the day, indicating, you know, he's napping around, he's laying around. Not only is he not out fighting wars, he's kind of like not doing nothing. And if you're probably who was a type A personality like David, if you're sitting around and you're doing nothing, you're probably bordering on depression, right? So David's up, haven't been sleeping, gets up, he's wandering around. So he's not actively engaging in any good activity. It's not even that he's actively engaging in bad things. In one sense, he's not doing what he's supposed to be doing, but he's not sitting up on the roof, you know, conspiring with himself about how he's going to, like, you know, murder puppies and kittens. Like, that's not what he's doing. He's just up there and he's kind of meandering around the roof, and he sees something and he doesn't turn away from it. And that, we all know that. David should have, like, seen that and been like, I'm going to give you the privacy you're not asking for. Right? And this is something, if you've raised young men, you know you have to teach them. You have to teach men to look away. You have to say, hey, there's something that people are going to present things to you, and you have to tell yourself, I'm going to give that person something they're not asking for me to give them. I'm going to be dignified. I'm going to be decent. Even though they don't want me to be, I'm going to be. I'm not placing any blame on Bathsheba. I did that once and got in a lot of trouble. I kind of still hold that position, but I'm not going to say it this morning any more than what I just said, because I don't want you yelling at me afterwards. So she's out there bathing in the open, right? Whatever. Maybe that's customary. Maybe it's not. I don't see how it is, but whatever. That's what she's doing. David looks, he looks again, and then he doesn't stop looking. And then he inquires, and the servant tries to help David. He says, hey, who's that? Look, down there. And the guy's like, I want to look. He's like, look. He's like, all right, that's Uriah's wife. The wife of Uriah, one of your mighty men. If David had never met Bathsheba, I'm kind of shocked, to be honest with you. If she is within visual distance from the palace roof, it's the wife of one of his mighty men. I don't know entirely how to solve what's going on here and what David is doing, the kind of the mental and emotional and spiritual gymnastics that is kind of going on in his mind. But it doesn't seem that David's being straightforward with anybody, especially himself in all this situation, right? So David looks, he looks again, he calls somebody, who's this? I want you to make an introduction, right, is what this is all about. The guy tries to get him to like think clearly, David doesn't do it. So a series of missteps, right? At any one of these points, David, a man after God's own heart, could have heard the voice of God saying, David, knock it off, stop what you're doing, this is not going to turn out well, but he doesn't. The Bible also warns us a lot about this. Not only does it warn us about success, James 1, 14 and 15 talks about how our desire, it breaks it down for us, how desire leads to sin and how that sin ultimately leads to death. 1 Peter 5, verse 8 talks about how the devil is constantly prowling around us. And if you've got a lion constantly prowling around you, you don't act like that's not happening. It is happening. It's always happening. Proverbs 4, verse 23 says, keep your heart with all vigilance, for from it flows the springs of life. Jesus told his disciples in Matthew 26, verse 41, watch and pray that you may not enter into temptation. The Bible, from cover to cover, God's trying to always tell us, be aware, be looking out. Hey, there's dangers everywhere. And Satan is working in ways that you don't even understand that he's working, but he's constantly coming for you. So the problem isn't that David lacks... it's not that David is experiencing contentment. That's not it. That's too simplified. That's kind of flattening out this whole thing to say, well, David's content and all this is a problem of his contentment. Contentment is something that's commanded of us. We're supposed to be content. It seems to be a combination of contentment with this lack of awareness that is an awareness of dangers without and dangers within. David is not being aware of what he is capable of being. And that always puts us in a bad spot. Whenever we start thinking, I've gotten to this place in my life, in my relationship with God, where I'm no longer tempted by these things that maybe I was tempted in the past or that are common temptations for people, then we find ourselves in a position where we're fixing to fail. So oftentimes we say, well, look out for Satan, look out for Satan. But you got to look out for Satan inside your heart. Because until Jesus comes back and perfects us, there's a small apartment-sized space always in all of us where he resides. And he's talking to us and he's trying to get us to do things the way that he wants us to do them. And so this high moment in David's life requires extra vigilance. I guess that's my point. When we find ourselves really doing well, what we want to do is relax. What we ought to do is be hyper-vigilant. We ought to be super concerned. And so that's how we keep ourselves from taking something that's good, a time in our life that's good, and turning it into something that's bad. Is we do the exact opposite, which is often the case with God, right? Than what is natural for us. Well, if we find ourselves like David, having done something that we shouldn't do, he knew he shouldn't have done it, he ignored all the voices, he's now in this place. What has happened between him and Bathsheba has happened. And there's a product of that. There's a baby on the way. There's a pregnancy that has taken place. This is tricky now, right? You're in a tricky situation if you're David. How do you handle that, and how do you keep from making a bad situation an even worse situation? I think to answer that question from the text, we have to kind of try to understand David's motives alongside of his actions, right? So David, from this point, does a whole series of terrible things, which we'll talk about. But you have to kind of ask yourself, why is David doing what David is doing, right? So David brings Uriah home with the attempt of covering up the pregnancy, right? Plausible deniability. It's a perfect and not new politician move. Plausible deniability. Well, that baby looks like King David. Well, it can't be King David's because Uriah was home 9 months ago or whatever, right? David is trying to plant seeds of doubt to where he can deny, that never happened. I know people saw what they think they saw, but Uriah was home. Clearly, that's Uriah's child. Bathsheba would never... he's my mighty man. I would never do that. I'd never betray him. Whatever. Plausible deniability. He's trying to work up a story to cover up the reality of what he's done. When that doesn't work, by the way, David tells Uriah to go home. with the assumption of something's going to happen, right? We're all adults, I don't have to say it. So David sends Uriah home with the assumption that something's going to happen. Uriah's been away from home for a long time. Something's going to happen, right? Uriah sleeps on the steps of the palace. Someone comes to David and says, dude, Uriah's like acting like a homeless person out there, right? He's sleeping on the steps. He won't go home. He won't leave. What's up with Uriah? So David asks, essentially, Uriah, what's going on? Go home. Go be with your wife. Go act normal, right? I need you to be normal right now. Did you hear what Uriah said? This is, if again, like, why did it take a sheep story to get David to, like, flip on himself? Uriah says, the Ark of the Covenant resides in a tent. And the men that are fighting this battle are out on the front lines, implied, in tents. How can I go home and sleep in my comfortable bed with my wife and enjoy those pleasures of life? How could I possibly? You know who Uriah is quoting? He's quoting David. This is essentially what David said when he wanted to build the temple. He came to God and he said, God, how can I, the king of Israel, that's the king of Israel because you made me the king of Israel, because you're the king of the earth, live in a palace while you dwell in a tent? Uriah has learned from David how to be spiritually minded about these things. He has ordered his life the way that David has taught him to order his life as a man who is after the heart of God. And here Uriah is telling David, I can't do that. I can't go and be comfortable at home when the men are out there in the battlefield and the Ark of the Covenant is sitting in a tent. I have no right to experience that level of comfort. And David doesn't even hear his own words. He doesn't even hear himself and see himself in what Uriah does. Why is David missing it? Why is he not hearing Uriah? Why does he then go and get Uriah drunk and try to get him to go home? Why does he then, when that doesn't work, send Uriah with specific instructions to put him out there and leave him so that he gets slain by the enemy? Why does he loop in his general? Why does he loop in the other people involved? Why does David allow other men of his army to be slain just so Uriah will die? You saw that, right? It wasn't just Uriah who died. I think sometimes we think of the story and it's like, oh, Uriah's there and he's standing out there and he's, you know, doing his thing. And then everybody runs away and Uriah gets shot. The story actually is they go out and who gets caught up in this attack is not just Uriah, but other men. Other men die. It's not just the one guy that David's trying to deal with because he's an inconvenient reality, inconvenient truth. Why does David do all of this? It's because David wants two things. David wants Bathsheba. He wants her. But David doesn't want to trade Bathsheba for the appearance of righteousness. He wants both. And this is where it kind of gets ugly for me. I don't know about you. When I take a bad thing that I've done and I make it worse, it's almost always because of some form of this exists in me. It's because it's not bad enough to want the bad thing, but I want the bad thing, and I also want to appear like I don't want the bad thing. And that's where it goes from this to this. Think of the cost, the planning, the sacrifice that David puts into appearing righteous. This is something we teach our kids. If you were just righteous, it would have been so much easier. The right thing for David to do was to call his household together and say, I've done a bad thing. He should have followed the pattern of King Abimelech, who took Abraham, or took Sarah, and God came to him and said, I'm going to kill everybody in your family if you don't give her back, and you're not allowed to lie with her. Abimelech, not a Jew, brings everybody together, his whole family, says, I've sinned before the Lord. And that he didn't even know he was doing anything wrong. But he was a man of integrity. And he knew that the best way to handle it was to just get it out there, to repent of it, to let everybody know this is what I've done. I shouldn't have done it. God told me, and we're moving in a different direction now. This is what we're doing. That would have cost David's dignity. It would have cost him his pride. It would have cost his belief of who he was, his persona. But it wouldn't have cost Uriah his life. It wouldn't have cost those unnamed soldiers their lives. It wouldn't have caused a general to have to work deceptively behind the scenes for a king's plausible deniability. It would have likely restored Bathsheba instead of making her what forever is kind of a scandal. You go into Matthew chapter 1, what is Bathsheba called in Matthew chapter 1 in the genealogies of Jesus? The mother of Solomon? Nope. The wife of Uriah. It's a scandal that she, like, God preserves it as a scandal forever. Puts it in his eternal word. The wife of Uriah. All of that could have been avoided if David would have not been so bent and so dedicated to having two things that are, in fact, mutually exclusive to each other in God's eyes. So how do we make a bad thing worse? It's when we do that. That's it. Bad things can be undone. Sometimes there are consequences to those bad things. I don't know what God would have done with the child. I don't know. I don't know what the outcome of that would have been. Would he have changed it? Would it have been? I don't know. I don't know how to sift through that. Maybe we can ask him someday. There maybe would have been consequences, but they certainly would not have been, it doesn't seem, would have been as vast as they ended up being. So how, if we find ourselves, and by the way, let me just say this. I think this applies both to if you mess up, right? And you make it right there, you kind of open your eyes, you realize, okay, I messed up. I need to fix this. Or if you mess up and then make a bad situation worse. I think all of these things apply to both of those things. And this is just what we see happening in David when we get into chapter 12. You look at chapter 12, 1 through 15. You have Nathan coming to him, certainly with God's help, right? The Spirit conjures up, knows the heart of David, his thoughts and intentions. He understands all of that, can divide between them. And he tells Nathan, all right, here's the story. You go tell this story to David. And it's kind of magical. Those of us that work with people in a spiritual capacity covet the talent of being able to come up with the perfect parable to turn the hearts of people that we serve. And that's what Nathan pulls off here. Nathan has a great day, right, in the work of the kingdom. He goes to David and he tells him this story of injustice. How a man had this lamb. And it was the family lamb. This guy probably named the lamb, right? The thing you're not supposed to do with livestock. It was in his house. It was a part of his family. David would have understood this, right? Because of his past. That's the second time I've done that today. I need to reel it in. He would have understood this, right? He had kind of these probably first name basis relationships with livestock. It's what he used to do. And then there's this guy that's got all of the sheep in the world. But he's got his eyes on that guy's single lamb. He takes it and he sacrifices it in kind of a chance meeting of somebody, right, that he's hosting. And David loses his mind. David takes it as something that's like seemingly actually happened. I want to know who this guy is. And that's David's job as the king, to bring justice, right? To know the law and to enact justice when justice was necessary. So David, being the king, hears this and he stands up all self-righteous, all full of indignation, all ready to take action. He says, tell me who this guy is. And Nathan, again, a stroke of genius, looks at him, and I can imagine that was a steely look. Probably the same kind of look that David gave Goliath when he stood out on that open plain and he said, you don't understand what's happening to you today, bro. The God of gods has sent me out here and you are done. You are done. And David knew it with every ounce of his heart that Goliath was going to fall before him. I'm sure that Nathan had that same look as he looked at David. Steely look. You are the man. This is the very thing that you did. That's an important time in life. Again, we read the story so often and we know it so well, I think, that we don't realize like the moment that David finds himself in there. Those moments don't happen every day. They honestly just don't, because we don't do this to ourselves every day. But when they happen, we need to recognize the gravity of the moment. Because David could have hardened his heart and executed Nathan. And based on the way that the political structure was in the time, nobody would have thought anything about it. And David could have covered that up as well. Could have conjured up some crazy story, right, about the whole thing and covered himself up. Would there have been whispers? Sure. Would people be suspicious? Yeah. But David could have done that. Instead, David wrote Psalm 51. David realized what he had done. And he repented. I mentioned this the other night in a conversation, last night in a conversation. One of the things that's always stuck with me in that is that David says a lot of things, but one thing he says is, to you and you alone have I sinned. David, and that's not, that sounds to, I think, the human ear and to the human heart, like David's excusing away his behavior. But I think David realizes, ultimately, that's who I've hurt the worst here. And that's an incredible statement, an incredible thought. I mean, you murdered a man, you lost a baby, you caught the whole kingdom up in this nonsense. There's all these things that we've already talked about, and you're telling me that the worst thing that David did is he broke God's heart. And I think that the answer to that is yes. The worst thing that David did is he broke God's heart. To you and to you alone have I sinned. And then David begs God, forgive me of the iniquity of my sin, which doesn't make any sense, right? I said this last night. Sin is iniquity and iniquity is sin. Those are interchangeable things. But David says, forgive me of the iniquity of my sin, which means David realized that he had come from a place down to another place. And it wasn't just about making a single mistake and not knowing how to deal with it. David's sin came from a heart of iniquity. He had in his heart fallen from where he once was. And that's hard. That's that pit that we dig ourselves into, that we look up and we say, I don't know how to do this. I don't know how to get out of this. And the way that he got out of it was through justice and mercy. And those are things that we don't like. We don't like justice and mercy, right? We want mercy without justice. That's what mercy is to us. But this story stands forever as a story that teaches us that God will forgive, but he doesn't erase. There are consequences to our conduct. There's reality that comes from the choices that we make that God is not going to take out of the way. He wants us to live with it, and I think it's a grace that we live with it because it reminds us of where we've been. It reminds us of what we once were, that we're trying not to be anymore with the grace of God. And it's a good example of things that we just don't see working together, like truth and grace or justice and grace. Both of those things existed simultaneously for David. And David accepted that. He accepted the forgiveness of God and the consequences of God, and he didn't interchange those things. And oftentimes we fail to rejoice in forgiveness and mercy because we're too caught up being kind of bitter about the consequences. And that prevents us from rejoicing in God's forgiveness and understanding the value of the consequences. And David kind of understood both of those things. Ultimately, what God does at the end of this, though it seems tragic, is he shows David grace, and that grace teaches David to say no. This is the very thing that Paul told Titus in Titus 2, verses 11 and 12. That we are compelled by the grace of God to say no to the evils of this world. We're taught by the grace of God. We're schooled by the grace of God to do the hard thing, do the right thing, to repent of our evils, and to get back on track, chasing after God's heart, while at the same time we crucify our own. It's a hard story, right? But it's a story that teaches us that no matter how bad we make it, God can get us out of it in the way that God gets us out of it. But we may have to live with the realities of what we've done, and those are not really bad in the end. Those are actually good. Those are pleasurable things, are positive things for us. All right, we'll cut it off there. Thanks, everybody. I think we're kind of done. Yes? Do we?